Well, welcome, my dear brothers and sisters and young people, to our midweek study class, where our brother Brian is to continue his study from the prophecy of Isaiah, and also to continue this evening his exposition of Isaiah chapter 27. We're not to have an opening hymn this evening, we'd have a halfway hymn, which our brother Brian has thought very suitable to put in his talk, or in the middle of his talk, because the words are so appropriate coming from the prophecy. So if you all rise, we'll beseech our Father's blessing upon our assembly here together. Our brother Brian has asked that we read once again as an introduction from the prophecy of Isaiah chapter 27, and we'll call upon Brother Nathan Taylor to lead us in the reading of that chapter.
Reading Isaiah chapter 27. In that day, Yahweh, with his sore and great and strong sword, shall punish Leviathan, the piercing serpent, even Leviathan, that crooked serpent, and he shall slay the dragon that is in the sea. In that day, sing ye unto her, a vineyard of red wine, I, Yahweh, do keep it, I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it, I will keep it night and day. Fury is not in me. Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them, I would burn them together. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he might make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. He shall cause them that come of Jacob to take root. Israel shall blossom and bud, and fill the face of the world with fruit. Hath he smitten him as he smote those that smote him? Or is he slain according to the slaughter of them that are slain by him? In measure, when it shooteth forth, thou wilt debate with it. He stayeth his rough wind in the day of the east wind. By this, therefore, shall the iniquity of Jacob be purged, and this is all the fruit to take away his sin, when he maketh all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder. The groves and the images shall not stand up. Yet the defence city shall be desolate, and the habitation forsaken, and left like a wilderness. There shall the calf feed, and there shall he lie down, and consume the branches thereof. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women come and set them on fire, for it is a people of no understanding. Therefore he that made them will not have mercy on them, and he that formed them will show them no favour. And it shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. And it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which are ready to perish in the land of Assyria, and the outcasts in the land of Egypt, and shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem.
Thanks, Brother Nathan. Now, without further ado, call upon Brother Brian to speak to us on Isaiah chapter 27.
Thanks, Brother Roger, and my dear brothers and sisters, and dear young people. In our 27th chapter, we last time did the first two or three verses thoroughly, and then we ran through verses 4 to 6 rather quickly. So I'm just going to paraphrase the first couple of verses and just fill a little bit more in then in verses 4, 5 and 6 that I think will help a lot in coming to grips with the meaning of those verses. Verse 1 was a day of divine judgment. There was an accent upon the description, a sore and great and strong sword. And in a summary manner, the power of the Gentiles, ruled by flesh, was described in four remarkable descriptions: the piercing serpent, Leviathan, the crooked serpent, and the dragon that is in the sea. And we saw the correlation of those terms with Revelation 12 and verse 7, isn't it? Where again we had a grouping of those similar expressions as speaking of the great power of Gentiledom. And then in chapter 20 of Revelation, in which also there was a collection of very similar phrases. And so we can see that verse 1 is a statement of divine judgment, historic judgment, determined judgment of God. And then in stark contrast, in absolutely stark contrast, we read in verse 2, in that day, the same day of divine judgment, a singing unto her a vineyard of red wine. And we noted that that was a strange and remarkable expression. You see leaves, you might see boughs, you may see bunches of fruit, but you don't see red wine. And the essential idea of that red wine, the word chemer, was that it had fermented, it was mature. So in one stroke, as it were, this vineyard has brought forth its product. The vine was of no avail whatsoever unless it brought forth its product. And this vineyard is immensely successful. Everything you ever plant a vineyard for is there, and it's there remarkably quickly. A vineyard of red wine, just pouring out of it, as it were. It's a remarkably interesting expression. And just by the way, last Sunday week we were at Brother Nathan Shaw's, and they've just put in some new vines. Got a little piece of new territory, 10 acres, and they've put in some new vines. And I was quite intrigued to hear what he was saying. Because of the new technique in which they graft, and the little vine goes in as a larger plant, see? Costs more, but he said, you know, within 15 months, we are where we might have been in 3 years. So he used the term an instant vineyard. You know how today everything's instant, isn't it? And so Nathan said, just compare that, he said, with what it might have been. It's like an instant vineyard. And I thought, well, isn't that just what we've got here? But this is better than that, isn't it? We haven't crushed a berry. We haven't gathered a bunch. But we've got a vineyard of red wine. In other words, it's gone straight through in a wonderful sense of productivity. It's highly successful. It's a wonderful harvest. God has richly blessed it. And so the divine interest is indicated in verse 3. A remarkably wonderful verse compared to the other vineyard in chapter 5. In which, because he found that it was of sour grapes, he gave it away, didn't he? And said, look, I'm not going to care for it any longer. I will not water it. I refuse the clouds to go upon and water that ground. And if the animals come from outside, well, so be it. I'll knock the wall down, take away the hedge. But now it's not like that. I will water it every moment, lest any hurt it. I will keep it night and day. So this is a different era for God's relationship to Israel. And so that is then tenderly and beautifully expressed in the next phrase in verse 4. Fury is not in me. See? And remember the RSV said, I have no wrath, says the RSV. It's a changed relationship that God has with his people. Now, in chapter 40, just turn quickly to chapter 40, we have the sense of that changed relationship. Comfort ye my people, saith your God. Speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem, and cry unto her that her warfare is accomplished, that her iniquity is pardoned. For she hath received of Yahweh's hand double for all her sins. And that's very much like the sense of Isaiah chapter 27. Because this chapter too, you remember from the headings that I gave you last time, this has also to do with the taking away of Israel's sins, as chapter 40 does. So these passages work in together very well. And then it says in verse 4, in this time of tranquility towards Israel, Who would set the briars and thorns against me in battle? I would go through them, I would burn them together. And the briars and thorns are representative of the Gentile peoples. Do you remember the passage that Brother Roger was, wasn't it, referred to last class? Had three times something and five times something. Remember that passage? I just made a little comment about it last. I bet Roger does. Numbers, that's right. It's all in Numbers. Numbers 33 and 55. But if you will not drive out the inhabitants of the land from before you, then it shall come to pass that those which ye let remain of them shall be pricks in your eyes and thorns in your sides, and shall vex you in the land wherein ye dwell. They are thorns and briars. Another passage of similar import, perhaps a little more dramatic, is in Judges. Judges chapter 8, on the occasion of the Moabites, sorry, not the Moabites, of the Ammonites being, Midianites, I'm sorry, the Midianites being pursued by Gideon. In Judges chapter 8 and verse 15, you remember the men of Succoth let go two of the kings of Midian. And so in verse 15 we read, and he came unto the men of Succoth and said, behold, Zebah and Zalmunna, with whom ye did upbraid me, saying, are the hands of Zebah and Zalmunna now in thine hand, that we should give bread unto thy men that are weary? And he took the elders of the city and thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them he taught the men of Succoth a lesson. In other words, they were not prepared to come to the call of the faithful Israelite leader and remove the Gentile from his sight. They would watch to see who's going to be the winner of this battle, and at the end they would join the winner. And so he taught them a lesson. You leave, he says, those Midianites in your land, and it will be forever thorns and briars in your sight. Which, of course, is what Numbers had said. So that's the basis on which in Isaiah chapter 27 we said that the briars and the thorns were representative of the Gentiles. Quickly turning back to chapter 5, you'll notice there was a reference to the briars and thorns. In Isaiah 5 and verse 6, when that vineyard was laid waste, I will lay it waste, it shall not be pruned nor digged, but there shall come up briars and thorns. See? So it's reasonable, therefore, on the basis of those passages, to say that this is representative of the flourishing of the Gentiles. Well, would the Gentiles be set against God in battle? That's a rather hopeless cause, isn't it? To set ourselves against God in battle. I would go through them, says God. I would burn them together. It is not a time when God is going to brook a challenge. But he said, I don't wish to do that. I give them an alternative. And it's the briars and thorns that are being spoken of. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me. And he shall make peace with me. Who? The Gentile. So not only in verse 4 do we have, my fury is not in me towards Israel, but there is a little opening of the door also to the briars and thorns. That if they wish to be reconciled to God and to take away that state of enmity, then that's all right with God. He would make peace with them too. That's a beautiful, beautiful statement, isn't it? Now, it's the 57th chapter, which I think I referred to, but I don't think we actually looked up last time, but that helps your understanding there. In Isaiah 57, keeping our hand in Isaiah 27, of course, but 57 now, in verse 19. See, he repeats that twice, doesn't he, in chapter 27. Or let him take hold of my strength, that he may make peace with me, and he shall make peace with me. See, it's perhaps an unexpected thing. He may not think that he can draw near unto the God of Israel, but if he does draw near, I will make peace with him, says God. So you see, so his heart is good towards Israel, and it's good to others as well. So in the 57th chapter, verse 19, I create the fruit of the lips. Peace. Not once, but twice. He repeats it like he did in chapter 27. Peace to him that is wherever he is, afar off, and to him that is near, saith Yahweh, and I will heal him. Not the wicked, verse 20. If they want to continue on in their wickedness, then I will go through them as though they were stubble and briars and thorns. The wicked are like a troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There's no peace, saith my God, to the wicked. But there is a message of peace, twice repeated, a divine affirmation, both to him that is afar off, that is the Gentile, and to him that is near, that is Israel. And just in case you're not sure that to say that is Israel and the Gentiles, keep your hand there. Quickly come to Ephesians 2. This is where your underlining of things with red ink is of such immense help. It just lets the whole passage just come straight up in front of your eye. In Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 17, the apostle's talking about those who were once aliens from the Commonwealth of Israel and being brought in to the state of hopefulness in the Commonwealth of Israel. And there in verse 17 is our quote, isn't it, from Isaiah 57 verse 19. Okay? He came and preached peace to you which were afar off, that is Ephesians, a long way away, and to them which were nigh, that is to those who were Israelites. But you know, that quotation has only summarised in verse 17 what he began in verse 13. But now in Christ Jesus, you who sometimes were far off, see, are made nigh by the blood of Christ. For he is our peace, who hath made both one. End of verse 15. Making in himself of twain one new man, so making peace. So when he therefore gathers it all together in verse 17, it's only just summarising really the quotation from Isaiah which he began to expound in verses 13 to 17. And so we can say unequivocally that the afar off is a reference to the Gentiles and the near is a reference to those of Israel. And so it's natural therefore in chapter 27 that we should sense that there is a Gentile inclusion in the invitation. That's a very beautiful thought, isn't it? A vineyard of red wine, and yet the door partly opens, the door of faith to the Gentiles, even within this context. They don't have to be at enmity with God. So if we come back now to verse 5 of Isaiah 27, we can summarise that verse by saying, don't take a course of folly that has no hope, where you set yourself against God, but take a wiser course and make peace with him. Can you think of a psalm which has both those thoughts in it? It's an early psalm. Has both those thoughts in it. Where there's a confederacy against God, and he says, be wise and do something else. Psalm 2, isn't it? It's very akin to Psalm 2. Psalm 2, verse 1. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Why do the thorns and the briars set themselves against God, as though they can undo his appointments? Kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together against Yahweh and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast away their cords from us. They don't need to do that. They don't have to do it. There's a better way. He shall speak unto them in his wrath, verse 5, and vex them in his sore displeasure. That's a policy of no hope. It's going to end in certain destruction. But here's a better policy. Verse 11, verse 10, be wise now, therefore, ye kings. Be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Make peace. Serve Yahweh with fear. And rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son. lest he be angry and he perish from the way when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. Isn't that beautiful? That's exactly the sentiment. Psalm 2 just fits straight in to verses 4 and 5 of Isaiah 27. A wiser counsel is to make peace with God. So, there was opportunity being given to the Gentiles to become part of this vineyard, to be grafted into this wonderful fruitfulness. And so in verse 6, that fruitfulness is beautifully expressed. It's an amazing verse, verse 6. It's perhaps without a competitor in describing the wonder of that increase. What a vineyard! And what a remarkable contrast with the vineyard which we have in chapter 5. Now, we've got a little summary of that contrast with chapter 5. We did deal with it last week, but Peter's very helpfully prepared this lovely transparency and sets out the two vineyards, or two stages really, I suppose, of the one vineyard, isn't it? On the one hand, it's a miserable disappointment in chapter 5 and he just gives it away. And on the other, it is full of fructification, full of wonderful success. In verse 5 it specifically says the hedge is removed and the wall broken down. And in verse 3 of chapter 27 it says it is kept by Yahweh. In verse 6 it says the clouds were commanded not to rain. And in chapter 27 he says I will water it every moment. Verse 6, he says, I will lay it waste. On the other hand, he guards it night and day. Verse 6 of chapter 5, the briars and thorns abound. But in verse 4, the briars are threatened with destruction, or otherwise they can make peace. And in verse 7, the only product of that vineyard was not the judgment of righteousness which he came to see. I looked for judgment, but behold, in fact, all he found in that vineyard was a cry of the oppressed. But on this occasion, there is righteousness and judgment galore, and it fills the world. It floods over its own boundaries, and it fills the face of the world with fruit. Do you know an equal expression to that in all of the prophets, to speak of the glory and fructification of the people of Israel? Now, in chapter 5, there was a question asked. In chapter 5 and verse 4. Got chapter 5 and verse 4. Having done everything that was reasonable, God made a question. What could have been done more to my vineyard that I have not done in it? And the sense seems to be, I couldn't have done another thing. Well, keep your hand in chapter 5 and quickly turn over to Mark 12. I don't think we went to Mark 12 last time, or did we? Did we? No? Well, this is very, very beautiful. Mark chapter 12. Don't worry about the transparency now. I'll have a look at that later. In Isaiah 5, you remember that the heading of Isaiah 5 was, now will I sing to my well-beloved a song of my beloved touching his vineyard. My well-beloved hath a vineyard in a very fruitful hill. All right? Now, in Mark chapter 12, Jesus began to speak unto them by parables. And it says in verse 1, a certain man planted a vineyard and set a hedge about it and digged a place, the wine vat, and built a tower and let it out to husbandmen and went into a far country. Those details are clearly taken from Isaiah chapter 5. Okay, got your red ink? That helps us, doesn't it, to index that immediately. Tells us where the passage comes from. Right? Isaiah 5. What's the Lord Jesus going to make of that? Everything was done for that vineyard, was it? Well, this is any. He doesn't. It's not cast irrevocably in the mould of Isaiah 5, but the elements are similar, and yet here and there they differ. Now, here's the difference. Take verse 4. Again he sent unto them another servant. At him they cast stones, wounded him in the head, and sent him away shamefully. Again he sent another. And him they killed, and many others, beating some and killing some. What more could be done to that vineyard? Isn't that almost coming up out of the surface? What more could God do for his people? One further thing he could do, greater than anything he had yet done. Having yet therefore one son, his well-beloved, he sent him also last unto them, saying, they will reverence my son. That's the one thing that's different, isn't it? That's the greatest thing he could have done. That was the one thing extra that he could do that he had not done in the days of the prophets. And what was the reaction to that? The husband said, this is the heir. Come, let us kill him and the inheritance shall be ours. They thought they'd take that vineyard away with themselves. If they killed the heir, then it had no one to be given to. It should then be theirs. What shall therefore the Lord of the vineyard do? He will come and destroy the husband and will give the vineyard unto others. Unto whom, my dear brothers and sisters, will he give that vineyard? Unto Gentiles. To others that had not yet received his various messengers that came. But did that mean to say that the son having come, he therefore would have no further inheritance in that vineyard? That the vineyard would go on, but the son had been cast out and was dead? Well, it would mean that without resurrection, wouldn't it? And in the following verse, Jesus goes on to say, in a really remarkably interesting way, he says, have you not read this scripture? The stone which the builders rejected is become the centre of God's operation. It's become the head of the corner. If you're talking of stone, that's what it will be. The head of the corner. But if you were talking of vineyard, what you'd say is that will become the central vine of that vineyard. He's just changed the symbol, see? But the point Jesus is making is that that which they cast out is not rejected by God, but it comes back and becomes the centre of God's operation. If you're not involved with that centre, you will not be part of the operation. That's why he's put that in. There was no passage in the Old Testament whereby he could illustrate that by means of the vine. But this passage in Psalm 118 about the stone clearly meant that. You reject him, it's that one that then God builds upon. Transfer that thought across to the vineyard. What's that saying? It's saying that man is going to become the head man of the vineyard. He's going to be the vine. The vine. He's not going to be grafted into anything else. They're going to have to be grafted into him. Because the building is built upon him. So if they're going to be part of that vineyard, part of the vineyard of Yahweh of hosts, they're going to have to be part of that stock. Grafted into him. If they're not, they won't be anything. Isn't that the sense of that? You think you'll get rid of me and you'll have a good time by yourselves. I'm telling you now, there's no hope for that policy. The vineyard will be around me. It is the vineyard of the well-beloved. That's what Isaiah said, and that's the term he uses when he introduced the son who came. Isn't that a remarkable insight? He's saying to them in the clearest terms, don't run away and think that you can rebuild something else. God has established that vineyard around me and in me. And there's no other way to go. What a remarkable passage. What an insight into the comprehension of the vineyard. It had to be that stock. It had to be the true vine. Now, in Psalm 80, I hope this is making a clear sense this time. We were in a bit of a gallop last time. But have a look at Psalm 80. It's about the vine, isn't it, that was brought out of Egypt. It's the basis on which Isaiah 5 and 27 and Ezekiel 19 too, if you'd like to make a little note, and John 15 are based. Psalm 80 verse 8. Thou hast brought a vine out of Egypt. Thou hast cast out the nations and planted it. Thou preparest room before it, and didst cause it to take deep root, and it filled the land. See, that's the same sense as taking root blossoming and budding and filling. Well, it filled the land. But the one in chapter 27 filled the face of the world with fruit. See the difference? See the difference? That's an intended difference. This one filled the land. It took root, it found the water underneath and then began to push. And every tree, every vine does that. It has to find its way through into the subsoils to the water underneath. In the southeast and other parts, they actually drill a hole through the limestone so that taproot can get down past the rock and get into the waters below. See? All right, he brought it into the land. It caused it to take deep root and it filled the land. The hills were covered with the shadow of it. The boughs thereof were like the goodly cedars. She sent out her boughs unto the sea and her branches unto the river. Why hast thou then broken down her hedges, says the psalmist in plea to God, so that all they which pass by the way do pluck her? The pig out of the wood doth waste it, and the wild beast of the field doth devour it. This is tragic. It began so well. Why have you let it to go to waste and rack and ruin? Return, we beseech thee, O God of hosts. Look down from heaven and behold and visit this vine, the vineyard which thy right hand hath planted, and the branch that thou madest strong for thyself. Burned with fire, it is cut down, they perish at the rebuke of thy countenance. And all that, to that point, is the natural planting of Israel, right? What was the one thing more that he could do for his vine? He could send his son. He could put his son into the sap of that vine. Right? He could put his own injection, as it were. He could implant himself directly into the growth of that vine in a way that would ensure that that vine would be successful and bring forth fermented and beautiful and sweet wine. So verse 17. When the other thing is burned with fire and cut down, and they perish at the rebuke of thy countenance, let thy hand be upon the man, the ish of thy right hand. Verse 15, the vineyard which thy right hand hath planted. This time it's personal. It's a son of God, directly related to God. Let thy hand be upon the ish of thy right hand. Sit thou at my right hand until I make thine enemies thy footstool. Remember? Psalm 110 verse 1. Upon the Son of Man, which is the term from Psalm 8, whom thou madest strong for thyself. In other words, that's a son of God, isn't it? A son of God in verse 17 is being promised that will be able to overcome where the original vine had not been. So will we not go back from thee. Quicken us and we will call upon thy name. Turn us again, O Yahweh, God of hosts. Cause thy face to shine, and we shall be saved. Now, isn't that an incredible psalm, my dear brother and sister? It spoke of all that wonderful growth and God planting it in the land when they came out of Egypt, but it all came to naught. But does the psalm end up in a doleful, pessimistic mood? No. Why not? Because God is personally involved, and he sends his son. I will send my son, they will reverence my son. But it seemed when he was cast out and destroyed, that was the end of it. But not God's son. He'd be raised from the dead, whom thou hast made strong to be at my right hand. And so he will persevere, and he will be able to overcome, whereas it had failed before. Now all of those thoughts are brought together in the most transcending way in John chapter 5. John chapter 15. And after this we're going to sing that lovely hymn 36, because it's just all about this, and that's the time to sing it, isn't it? A little bit different, but sometimes it's nice to be different, isn't it? If the meaning's there. John 15. I am, look at this, I am the true vine. Now, what do you think Jesus is saying by that? You thought you could toss me out and reject me hours to go before they do that. I am the true vine. What's that saying? Everything else that came before was false. It would never bear the right flavour. It didn't have the right ingredients. I am the true vine, and my Father is the husbandman. If there's any prophecies in Isaiah or any other place that have to do with the vine, I am the true vine. And you know, he's saying this when huddled around him is a little group of disciples who must have been almost fear-struck to be with him, because they could feel everything just clamming in on them as their master is taking this terrible road that's going to end up in death, and they can feel the awe of the moment. And yet he's gathering them around and saying, look, that's not like that at all. This is where things are going to begin. This is the source and substance of things. This is not the end, but the beginning. I am the true vine. All that's out there with all of its noise and its show and its plottings against me is all the false vine. We will replace that. My Father is the husbandman. I am his Son, the beloved. See the point? We're in cooperation together. They're outside God. God's planning is here, and they're outside of that. Imagine being in that little group, huddled up in that little room with him, and listening to that, and all the atmosphere and awe and dread that was building up around them. And this leader is so remarkably confident that he's galvanizing them with strength and new vision. Every branch in me that beareth not fruit, he taketh away. And every branch that beareth fruit, he purgeth it, that it may bring forth more fruit. He is a husbandman that wants fruitfulness. And there's your branches, you see, of Isaiah chapter 27. That the women come along and pick up and burn. Remember, we had it in our reading. Now ye are clean through the word which I have spoken unto you. Abide in me. Don't get outside that vine. Stay inside. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself except it abide in the vine, no more can ye except ye abide in me. Don't be drawn by forces outside. By forces outside of me, by all that's going on outside in that city. Stay in me, in this little group of fellowship that we have here, because this is the true thing. I am the vine, ye are the branches. He that abideth in me and I in him, the same bringeth forth much fruit. There surely must be the overtures of Isaiah 27. Shall blossom and bud and fill the world with fruit. For without me ye can do nothing. They're about to kill him. But without me ye can do nothing. And neither can they. If a man abide not in me, he is cast forth as a branch and is withered. There's your withering of the branches of Isaiah 27. And men gather them. Isaiah said women gather them, but Jesus has said men gather them. Romans, in fact, will gather them, won't they? Romans will gather them. Roman soldiers. And cast them into the fire, and they are burned. Like Isaiah 27 said would happen. If ye abide in me, and my words abide in you, ye shall ask what ye will, and it shall be done unto you. Herein is my Father glorified, that ye bear much fruit. So shall ye be my disciples. So, my dear brothers and sisters, we're now going to sing that Psalm 36, because the hymn 36, which is Psalm 80 in the scriptural record. Thanks, Naomi.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. That was a beautiful timing of that hymn, wasn't it? The right time to sing. Now, if you've got a little slip of paper that was handed out, it's got Isaiah 27, verses 7 to 10 on it. And sometimes a translation is extremely helpful, and you will find in the next few verses that that's the case. You remember what the heading for this section was? The atonement of Jacob's sin. Or the purging of Jacob's sin. I'm using the word atonement, perhaps, since I realise that this word purging is the word kephar, which is 15 times in the Day of Atonement legislation in Leviticus 16, is 16 times used there. So it's right for us to use the word atonement. See verse 9, by this therefore shall the iniquity of Jacob be atoned. Kephar, C-A-P-H-A-R. It's the word for atonement. So this is interesting to us. Remember that story I told you about where they were debating why has this happened to Israel about the Holocaust, and nobody could answer it. They've got no sense of why they're out there and what's happened to them. It's a most amazing thing. In an hour-long debate about the Holocaust, there was not one of them that dared mention Jesus Christ. Not one of them. Well, this is about the time when he would take away the iniquity of Jacob, be atoned for. It's exciting material. Verses 7 to 10. The atonement of Jacob's sin. And it says in the RSV, just reading it through, has he smitten them, Israel? Perhaps it's helpful just to sort of write a few little notes above so you've got the sense. All right, has he smitten them, Israel, as he, God, smote those who smote them? Has God smitten Israel as God smote those, the Gentiles, who smote Israel? Happy with that sense? Got that sense? It really changes the whole thing, doesn't it? Has God smitten Israel to the degree that he has smitten the nations who smote Israel? And the answer comes back, the second phrase is the same, or have they been slain? Has Israel been slain as their slayers were slain? Now the answer to that's given, isn't it? To that very question is given in Jeremiah 30. Have a look at the exactitude of this cross-reference. Jeremiah 30, verse 11. For I am with thee, saith Yahweh, says Jeremiah, to save thee. Though I make a full end of all nations whither I have scattered thee, yet will I not make a full end of thee. But I will correct thee in measure, and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. So the question is really being asked, isn't it? Has God cast off his people? Jeremiah said he would never do that in the terms in which he had done it to those who had scattered Israel. He would scatter them absolutely, and they'd never return to being a nation again. But I will correct thee in measure. Notice that word. I will correct thee in measure and will not leave thee altogether unpunished. So our verse 7 is really the same in essence. Notice this. It's the same in essence as Romans 11, verse 1, the words we know so well. I say then, says the Apostle Paul, Romans 11, verse 1, hath God cast away his people? God forbid. See? Will there be a permanent and utter destruction of them, like those who have risen up against them? And you know, that bears a lot of reflection, doesn't it? It is a remarkable thing. You think how great Babylon was. Where's Babylon today? Go and find it among the rubbish piles by the river Euphrates. A site for tourism, but for nothing else. Where have been the great nations like Assyria that have risen up against Israel in days past? All I know of Assyria is that there's a bunch of them in Sydney, in a suburb in Sydney, would you believe? They call their children Sennacherib and other things. That's all that I know is a remnant of Assyria. Where have they gone? Where's the Ammonites and Moabites? Where's the Philistines of old that gave Israel such a terrible time? Hath he smitten them as those that smote him? Wonderful thing, isn't it? God has preserved them. But it hasn't been easy, has it? They haven't been without chastisement. Look at verse 8. How does he explain that? In measure. And that was Jeremiah's word, wasn't it? It's the very same word in the Hebrew. It's the same sense. God has chastised them in measure, but not absolutely. And so our RSV takes that up again. Here we have it on the transparency, and it says this. In reply to the question, measure by measure, by exile, thou didst contend with them. He removed them with his fierce blast in the day of the east wind. But measure by measure. He could have let that east wind blow such that it would take them out of that land irrevocably, ever, forever. But he didn't. He removed them with his fierce blast in the day of the east wind. But it was by measure. Now I'll show you two other passages that are like that. Zechariah chapter 1 is one, where Babylon hopped in and really enjoyed this judgment upon Israel. God noted that and he gave them warning. In Zechariah 1 and verse 15 it says, I am very sore displeased with the heathen that are at ease, for I was a little displeased with Israel, and they helped forward the affliction. See? They got into it. And they relished that opportunity of coming against the gates of Jerusalem, destroying all its palaces and temples. And they thought that they were doing an eternal work, but I'm very displeased with that. There was a measure of judgment to come, but not total destruction. Isaiah 54, same sort of sense. I mean, how is it that this little nation continues to dominate such a large part of the world theatre today? In Isaiah 54 and verse 8. Lovely expression here. For in a little wrath I hid my face from them for a moment. My dear brothers and sisters, could bring tears to your eyes, couldn't it? In a little moment, in a little wrath I hid my face for thee for a moment, says God. Look at what they've been through. But with everlasting kindness will I have mercy on thee, saith Yahweh thy Redeemer. What's in store for Israel, my dear brethren and sisters? When they get the other side of the kingdom, they'll look back upon the Holocaust and they'll see it in its true perspective, as you'd never see it otherwise. It's the experience of someone who's gone through something that you haven't been through, and they speak upon that subject, and just as you listen, you know there's something about their understanding that's greater than yours, isn't it? Because they've been through it, true? That's how Israel is going to be. They will have gone through the most terrible things, but they'll come to the other side and they'll look back and they'll say, that was a little moment, but this is everlasting kindness. God will weigh it up right in his own time. So verse 8 puts this measure on the judgment of God. And it was done measure, by exile. Notice that word? By exile. How did the prophet know that it was going to be by exile that God would do that? How did he know that? You say divine inspiration, okay. But were there not prophecies already that spoke of that? Famous chapter. Deuteronomy 28, wasn't it? Deuteronomy 28 speaks of two exiles. We won't go back there. But Deuteronomy clearly said that it would be he'd take them into other lands, you see. So when the prophet said that in verse 8, it's distilling so much of what had gone before. Measure, by exile, thou didst contend with them. Not because he hated them or because he's going to destroy them, but because he would just chastise them sufficiently to make his point. And so the prophet then goes on, by this, therefore, as shall the iniquity of Jacob be atoned. Therefore, by this, says the RSV, the guilt of Jacob will be expiated or atoned. And the next phrase in the authorised is very difficult, isn't it? It says, and this is all the fruit to take away his sin. What do you make of that expression? This is all the fruit to take away his sin. What does that mean? Well, it doesn't really make sense. I've never been able to make sense of it. But the authorised, the RSV, has helped that, and it says, and this will be the full fruit of the removal of his sin. What will be the full fruit? Well, verse 6. That's the full fruit, isn't it? Israel shall blossom and bud and fill the face of the world with fruit. This will be the full fruit of the removal of his sin. Not until that sin has been removed will that fruitfulness be so obvious to all the world. So it's answering back to verse 6. How then will God deal with his people? He will in several occasions bring upon them limited exiles. Not forever, but for a period of time, 70 years. Then for a much longer period of time when the Romans came. But they will still return to their land. And then there will come a time of full fruitfulness when their sin has been removed. What were some of the features of their sin? Well, idolatry was a very key feature. And so in the rest of verse 9, the prophet notes that. He says, when he maketh all the stones of the altar as chalk stones that are beaten in sunder, the groves and images shall not stand up. So he's not going to do a deal with idolatry. He's going to beat the altars of these Asherim, these incense altars of the false gods of the Canaanites, which they took to themselves. He will dash them like chalk stones. You know what chalk stones are like? Very easily brought to powder. A good crack on a chalk stone, it just crumbles into a whole number of pieces. Well, says God, that's what I'm going to do with the altars of the Asherim. You know what the Asherim means? This word here, which is translated groves, it's this word Asherim here, plural, because it is plural, and it was the Canaanitish worship in which they placed upon the groves of the hills surrounded by trees, they placed symbols, exactly what our world does, symbols of seduction and immorality, of licentious living. The genitals and so forth of mankind and womankind. And they came and worshipped before those things. And as though they would hide it from God, they put trees around it. They really sort of got up there so it was comfortable for themselves. It was a wicked and terrible thing. God says the altars of those places will be like chalk stones. When I've done that, when I've taken away their sins. Now verse 10 in the authorised reads up a little bit difficultly, doesn't it? Because it says, yet the defence city shall be desolate. Well, we would sort of feel that if the altar was going to be chalk stones, then the defence city also would be desolate. So why does it say yet? Well, you notice that the Revised Standard Version is helpful again, because it, instead of saying yet, it says for. The fortified city is solitary. In other words, it's in agreement with the fact that God has broken down the altars of idolatry. For the fortified city is solitary. Though we built walls around it, there's no life inside. A habitation deserted and forsaken, like the wilderness. There the calf grazes, there he lies down and strips its branches. And so the ruin of Israel's cities are being told. And those places that were once defence cities have now become pastoral land for calves to feed. Now the prophet has used similar description in chapter 7. Do you remember in chapter 7 when he spoke of the desolation of the land? He said that that which was one time very highly cultivated would become open pasture land. Isaiah 7, verse 21. Shall come to pass in that day that a man shall nourish a young cow and two sheep. Very small herd, isn't it? But there's so much for him to feed upon that that provides him with plenty. It shall come to pass for the abundance of milk that they shall give, he shall eat butter. For butter and honey shall everyone that is left, shall everyone eat that is left in the land. There is an abundance of food even from such a small herd, because they can just eat their heads off. Food is just pouring out of them. It shall come to pass in that day, says the prophet, that every place shall be where there were 1,000 vines at 1,000 silverlings, that is, that cost 1,000 silverlings. It shall even be for briars and thorns. Beautiful, beautiful ground that was so rich and went for such high values is now just a place of briars and thorns. The land is void and empty. With arrows, with bows shall men come thither. It's a place for hunting of wild animals, because all the land should become briars and thorns. And all the hills that should be digged with the mattock. In other words, it was horticultural land that was carefully tended. There shall not come thither the fear of briars and thorns, but it shall be for the sending forth of oxen and for the treading of lesser cattle, or calves, as we have it in Isaiah chapter 27 and verse 10. So you get the sense, therefore, of verse 10. The city is ruined, the habitation forsaken, the place has become like a wilderness. This is the exile, see? By exile thou didst contend with them. And when they left the land, in its place, animals would feed where once there was habitation. All right, the calf shall feed and lie down and consume the branches thereof. The branches of what? In the context of this chapter. Not immediate context, I suppose. Context of the branches of what? Of the vine, isn't it? Of the beautiful vineyard. Then it says in verse 11, when the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. Why are the boughs withered? Because in chapter 5 God says, I will send no rain. In chapter 5 and verse 6, I will also command the clouds that they rain no rain upon it. So the boughs of Israel's vine are withered because the spiritual ingredients have not been provided for that people. He took away the prophet and the teaching priest and the wise man. And the nation withered because of the lack of divine input. And so, when the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. Now, you can see several echoes here, can't you? Just keep your hand there and come through to Luke 23. Here's a little echo. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. Jesus was in their midst then, in Luke 23, the Lord Jesus Christ, Son of God, teaching. It wasn't a drought yet, was it? In verse 28 of Luke 23, Jesus turning unto them said, daughters of Jerusalem, weep not for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children. For behold, the days are coming in the which they shall say, blessed are the barren, the wombs that never bear, and the paps which never gave suck. Then shall they begin to say to the mountains, fall on us, and to the hills, cover us. Terrible times. In the drought-stricken nature of that nation, when AD 70 really came upon them, and for 2 years that nation was invested by the Romans. Inside there was internecide hatred and bitter division, and outside there was fear on every side. And the Romans' determination was gathering all the time to exterminate that people, so much that they hate the Jews for all the trouble they had given them. They shall say to the mountains, fall on us, the hills cover us. It was not worth living. For, says Jesus in verse 31, if they do these things in a green tree, what shall be done in the dry, when the boughs thereof are withered up? They shall be broken off. And broken off they were indeed by the Romans. And of course it's in Romans chapter 11, isn't it? Where the Apostle Paul takes up this figure. And he speaks of branches being broken off. Romans 11, verse 17. Now you'll say to me, but isn't this about an olive tree? And Isaiah 27 is about a vine. But does it make any difference? If the figure of the type of tree is different, it doesn't change the sense, does it? Where else in the scriptures do we have the concept of boughs being broken off? There's nowhere else. It's in Isaiah 27 where that is found. If the first fruit be holy, verse 16, the lump is also holy. If the root be holy, so are the branches. And if some of the branches be broken off, as Isaiah 27 says, that's Paul's little bit in brackets. He knows where the passage comes from, doesn't he? It comes from our chapter. It comes from our chapter, my dear friends, that I dare to say, before we really got into it, we knew so little about, eh? And we would have been hesitant to go to Isaiah 27 to make much of it. But I want to make this point. The Apostle Paul, in this so important a chapter as Romans 11, freely went to the chapter that we're dealing with. Because he had spent time to understand it. I don't suppose he had a difficult translation like the Authorised Version has given us. But he went to it, didn't he? And he came to grips with that chapter. So that when he had to write about what shall be the future of Israel, he remembered Isaiah 27. That's the chapter that speaks about God's reasonings as to why he did this and that with his people. And that he did it in by measure, and he sent them away once and sent them away again to learn by that and come back a better people. See? And in the figures of that chapter, he spoke of them as being branches that were once in the vineyard but were broken off, and women came along and gathered them when they were withered and burnt them. And that's all here. So it's an important chapter, isn't it? All the scriptures are interesting and terribly important. And that's the distinctive feature of us as Christadelphians, isn't it? Other people wouldn't care a tuppenny tart about Isaiah 27. But we're different. All scripture is given by inspiration of God. And I find it really wonderfully encouraging to think that we just here in Brighton, in our little class, are coming through this track and we're picking up all these beautiful overtures where the apostles trod before. And you could count on one hand how many people have measured that in the last 20 years. And it's our privilege to do that. And it is a privilege, isn't it? A wonderful privilege to be in the apostles' company and think, well, some night he was making his tents and he sat down with that chapter and he said, what's this mean? And he unravelled that chapter just like you and I have. And he said, boy, that's interesting. And when I have to write a chapter about the future of Israel, I'll remember that chapter. And so he weaves it into the text. Boast not against the branches, verse 18, but if thou boast, thou bearest not the root, but the root thee. Thou wilt say then, the branches were broken off, that I might be grafted in. Well, because of unbelief they were broken off. And thou standest by faith. Be not high-minded, but fear. But if God spared not the natural branches, if he did, then take heed lest he also spare not thee. Isn't he able, verse 24, verse 23, to graft them in again? Don't they fit perfectly into the tree? If he can bring Australians into the hope of Israel with all of our boorish manners, isn't it a remarkable thing that he can, that we've been brought in? And surely he can bring back those people who are from Abraham, whose city was Jerusalem. If thou wert cut out of the olive tree, which is wild by nature, and wert graft contrary to nature into a good olive tree, how much more shall these, which be the natural branches, be grafted into their own olive tree? Didn't Isaiah speak of two vineyards? He didn't just speak of chapter 5 in doom, that God would neglect and finish and turn away from, but he spoke in chapter 27 of a vineyard of red wine, wonderfully fruitful. He will bring them in again. That's the sense of it, isn't it? And so all Israel shall be saved. That's blindness in part, you see. Measure by measure. Blindness in part has happened to Israel. Until. All right, now returning to chapter 27. We come to verse 11. When the boughs thereof are withered, they shall be broken off. The women come and set them on fire. Remember how Jesus said that the branches of the vine are of no use, no avail. You can't make anything, can you, out of a branch of a vine. You ever been with the farmer when he's been pruning his vine? There's nothing you can do with them. They're good for nothing. In fact, they used to have a little fire, didn't they, that they would bring down through the lines of the vines, and as you were clipping them, you just tossed them into the flame. Have you ever seen that being done? And this little receptacle would be burning all the time. We'd driven along by a horse today, but I remember it up at Clarendon. And as the coals formed, they would just go back straight into the soil there and then. Good for nothing. All right. Verse 11. What does that mean about the broken boughs? It means this. It is a people of no understanding. Therefore, he that made them will not have mercy on them. And he that formed them, what interest he would have in them, will show them no favour. Now those expressions, and I won't be going back to them, we can have a little chat about them later. The people of no understanding is Deuteronomy 32, verse 28 and 29. And that he will not have mercy on them is Hosea 1 and verse 6. And put a little note by that. Those two passages find their way also into Romans chapter 11. Isn't that just unbelievably wonderful? The apostle combs then into Romans 11. Now in verses 12 and 13. It shall come to pass in that day that Yahweh shall beat off from the channel of the river unto the stream of Egypt, and ye shall be gathered one by one, O ye children of Israel. For the word river, most translations have the Euphrates. It's the Hebrew word Nahar, N-A-H-A-R. It's in that day, that is the day of verse 1, the day of Christ's glory, the day of God's judgment, verse 2, the day of the vineyard of red wine. The time of God's changing towards his people after the exiles and the judgment. And it doesn't sound altogether welcoming at first, does it? It says that he will beat off from the channel of Euphrates unto the stream of Egypt, which I'm sure means the Euphrates in the north and the Nile in the south. And God is beating off. Now, what's your little picture in there? It's not that he's sort of got a stick and he's trying to stop Israel coming back, is it? Can't be that. Because it says, verse 13, it shall come to pass in that day that the great trumpet shall be blown. The trumpet is that which brings people, isn't it? It was used to draw the people, Numbers chapter 10, in congregation or for war or whatsoever purpose. That was the purpose of the trumpet. So when they come, God's not going to sort of beat them off in that sense, is he? This is the sense of it in chapter 17. Chapter 17 and verse 6. It's all about the gleaning. They'll come back to the land, the north and the south, and God will be there to gather his gleanings. Isaiah 17 and verse 6. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it. There's the vine. As the shaking of an olive tree, there's the olive tree. So if Paul switched the trees in Romans 11, any worry? The prophet himself did that, didn't he? Olive or vine made no difference. Both used as symbols of Israel. Yet gleaning grapes shall be left in it as the shaking of an olive tree. Two or three berries in the top of the utmost bough. Four or five in the utmost fruitful branches thereof, saith Yahweh, the God of Israel. And so he's there as a loving gatherer, gathering his gleaned grapes that have come through all that they've come through, and all the heaps of despisement that they've received in Gentile lands, and through all the Hitlers and the Eichmanns, and through all of those that have been taken in the Holocaust of Europe, and all the other tribulations which they've suffered in all that time. The God of Abraham, Isaac and Jacob will be there to beat them, as it were, to gather carefully all those that might fall down as gleanings, as a remnant that have come back. And he wants more. He wants every one of them. It shall come to pass in that day, verse 13, that the great trumpet shall be blown. There is passion and motion here, isn't there? He's not just blowing a trumpet and a few might come. They might be described as gleanings in verse 12, but he wants the whole lot of them to come home. that the great trumpet shall be blown, and they shall come which were ready to perish in the land of Assyria, the Russia of our days, and all of those northern areas where there are millions of Jews unto this day. And they must be rueing the fact, my dear brothers and sisters, they never got out in the last couple of years. You know, I saw just here a depiction of the determination of Russia. What's that? Do you know what that is? World War II, isn't it? But it's not. That's Grozny. You've never seen anything more devastating than that. What's that represent to the world? If you think you're going to get out from under me, have another think come. That's Russia's determination to hold her people together. And you couldn't have it in a more blank form than that. These people are ready to perish in the land of Assyria. Outcasts in the land of Egypt. And they're only being mentioned as typical of all of the areas of the earth. In chapter 11, it speaks of them coming from all nations, doesn't it? So it's not... Just quickly look at chapter 11. Because it says in chapter 11 and verse 16, there shall be a highway for the remnant of his people which shall be left. The last verse of chapter 11. A highway for the remnant of his people which shall be left from Assyria, like as it was to Israel in the day that he came up out of the land of Israel, the land of Egypt. So you've got again this north-south returning home of the exiles. But verse 12 put it in broader terms. He will gather together the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. But now coming back to the land, they come in, don't they, on the land? They come in either from the north or from the south. But the north and the south are being spoken of as symbolic of all of the countries. And then in a very beautiful expression, this regathered people, purified and gathered by God, brought into his garner and brought close to him as a vineyard of red wine that's now going to be extremely useful and resourceful in the kingdom age. It says they shall worship Yahweh in the holy mount at Jerusalem. What a beautiful expression that is. Can you imagine that today? Israel don't even do that today. People don't, even in Israel, go up to worship in the times of their feasts. But in that time, my dear brothers and sisters, those people are going to flood into that land and they're going to bow themselves down unto God and pour their hearts out unto him, worshipping Yahweh. The word means to bow down, to abjugate oneself before the God of all the earth. And they will do that in the holy mount at Jerusalem. And so this chapter finishes on that note. It is, in fact, of course, the Romans 11 of the Old Testament. So just quickly, Romans 11 now, as a final note. If God had not brought all these things upon that people, if he had not brought them in and sent them away again, and brought us in meantime, my dear brothers and sisters, balancing up those scales of divine opportunity, then we would never have had the perspective. Israel would never have had the perspective that they will have when they come home. And the Apostle Paul sing that the scales of balance. He says in verse 33, "Oh, the depth of the riches, both of the wisdom and knowledge of God, how unsearchable are his judgments." Look what he's done with Israel. In and out and in again. And the Gentiles out and now in, and now joined together with the Jewish people forever. How unsearchable are his judgments, and his ways past finding out. Whoever would have done it that way? For who hath known the mind of the Lord, or who hath been his counsellor? He quotes there from Isaiah 40, which had to do with God's balance in putting the earth and the seas where they are. And that same wonderful divine balance has been there in the handling of his people and in the calling by faith of the Gentiles. Or who hath first given to him, and it shall be recompensed unto him again. For of him, of God, and through him, and to him are all things, to whom be glory for ever. Amen.